This is an interview conducted with former Admiral Charles Dillon on December the 2nd, 1985, and the interview is being conducted by Sean Cafferty. Mr. Dillon, on the last interview with Mark Hill, you had left off in 1960 and you were writing a letter to Ken Dyer, and you were writing about your possible next appointment, and you wanted to see if you could be posted to the IDC, the Imperial Defense College, and I was wondering if you could just pick it up from that point.
Well, the whole point in doing this was because I had been in Ottawa for 6 long years, while the work was very interesting and I enjoyed it, there's a limit to being in the Navy serving in Ottawa, and I was anxious to get on to something a little different, a little newer. If they were thinking of sending me to some kind of defense college or staff college, it was likely to be the National Defense College in Kingston, Ontario, and that didn't excite me very much. That's 120 miles from Ottawa, and I thought, boy, that's not going to be the end all. So I had a number of people I knew had attended the IDC before, and they spoke about it with enthusiasm. And I felt it would be a broadening experience. So I wrote this letter, which I suggested to the chief of personnel, who was Ken Dyer, and I said if there was any thought being given to sending me somewhere, could they give consideration to that? And to my surprise, it came back and it was approved. So I left my job as supply officer in chief in November 1960. The course at the IDC began in January and ran right through to the latter part of December of 1961. We were fortunate as a family. Now, we had 3 children. We had our eldest son was 17, the second one was 14, and our daughter was 10.
Right.
They had been attending, obviously, schools in Ottawa for the previous 6 years. And before that, they were in schools in Halifax. And before that, they were in schools in Victoria. So we set out, and we were fortunate to the extent that it was about the last transatlantic trips by ship, because the following year, from 1962 on, everybody went by air in the old RCAF Yukons,
mm-hmm.
which were all right, but long trips. We sailed from Montreal on Great Cup Day, to tell you the truth, 1960. I think it was the 30th of November, which also was, and only it probably was a couple of days earlier than that. But I always remember, as we sailed out of Montreal Harbor, I asked if they could turn on the radio so we could get the commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting around, the boys and I and a few other Canadian passengers. There were very few passengers on that trip. There were only 30 first-class passengers, and we were fortunate we were in the first class. An Englishman came in and heard the business, and he said, "This is a great cup." He said, "What's that, a horse race?" very rough crossing. When we emerged from the Straits of Belle Isle, we ran into a gale. Indeed, it was a storm. The ship had to heave to for a matter of some 20-odd hours. And we never were without gale force winds the whole way across. And we went alongside in Le Havre, France, to discharge some passages. And it was still blowing in tremendous winds. We were pinned against the dock wall and we couldn't sail. So what was normally a 6-day trip or something, it took us almost 7 days to cross. We had a month in London getting organized. I had to find somewhere to live, but we were fortunate to find an apartment which had been rented the previous year by another Canadian who was on the 1960 IDC, a chap called Paul Bridle, who was from External Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to move into that place on the 1st of January. So we spent a month in a hotel in London. Which was all right because we had really no responsibilities other than finding somewhere to live, and I had to find schools for the kids. So we did a lot of sightseeing. Now, this question of schools is an important one, and it's one that affects all members of the forces who are sent off to different parts of the world. The only place where there's a certain continuity is when people go to the NATO forces in Germany, as they are now. Previous to that they were, because there DND provides schools and all the rest.
Which is actually on the base, I imagine.
Well, yes.
Similar to Baden-Baden.
Or else they subsidize your education for private schools. Well, I tried for the boys. I tried several English schools. They were what we would call private schools, and they call them public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't even look at the 17-year-old. They said, we can't even guarantee to keep him occupied because he was so out of phase.
Oh, he had gone beyond what their education
was. Well, he was in high school when we left. He was in grade 10 in high school in Ontario.
Right.
So I was getting kind of concerned about this. The 14-year-old wasn't so difficult, but again, they said, oh, well, we'll keep them occupied, but, you know, they have all their things about the old grade and their college entrance and everything. And I heard that the U.S. Air Force had a school at Bushy Park, a high school, and I was very fortunate in being able to place both the boys there. Know, this again was, if you will, an educational shock to them because the American system is different than the Canadian system, but it's a lot closer than the English system.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a very good time there. I don't know how much they learned, but the Americans always do things rather well, and they organized all sorts of trips for very cheap rates. I remember Patrick, the eldest, went off to Denmark and Sweden for a long weekend, and it only cost $45.
That's a good deal.
They stayed in youth hostels and things. And he got on what they call their varsity football team, and they would go to various German U.S. air bases to play the local team. So they got around. They went to Paris one time. They did all sorts of things. So that was all right. Daughter, we put into a convent school in London. Now, she was only 10, and that was not a success. She was called the fat little Canadian. She isn't now. She's still a Canadian. But she had a thoroughly unhappy time, and had I known, I found out too late, there was a U.S. Air Force again, elementary school in London, mm-hmm. and I think I could have got her in there. And of course, the grateful government paid the fees because we were charged as foreign nationals by the Americans,
mm-hmm.
but it was not an unreasonable. Well, then we, as a family, we had some leave in the summertime, and we had a car, and we drove over to the continent, and we went to France, Belgium, Holland, and Germany, and we had a very good trip. So this was all a good thing for the young people. It broadened their outlook, and they saw a lot of things they wouldn't have otherwise seen. In my case, I did a lot of traveling with the college in England, and then we had our big tour from mid-August to mid-September, and there were five different tours. We split up.
Mm-hmm.
There were 67 students in the college, of which 40 were British, and the other 27 were from other countries, 12 different countries. There were black ones and coffee-colored ones, and people from South Africa at that time, and Americans, Canadians, and the whole works, Indians, Pakistani. I went to Pakistan, Indian Ceylon on my tour. We were about 5 or 6 weeks doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And coming, we had an RAF aircraft that stayed with us.
During the entire tour for that 6 week period.
And we had a very thorough tour. We saw these countries very thoroughly and everything. And we were briefed by members of the government and members of the foreign diplomatic corps, we saw their military establishments, but we also saw a lot of the economic side and the social side too. And then coming home, we stopped. We went to East Pakistan too, which is now called Bangladesh. We went to Dhaka and then we, on the way home, we flew from Bombay to Aden, which was then a British colony. It's now called South Yemen and is independent. And then we flew from there across Ethiopia, and we couldn't fly over any Arab lands because the British were still fairly unpopular after the Suez invasion. So we flew into Libya, where the British had an air base at El Adam, which is a few miles from Tobruk.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a night there and then back to London. Then, in the latter part of, I guess, November, towards the end of the course, we received our postings or appointments, the Navy called them, for after the course. In my case, I was appointed as the naval officer in charge of Montreal and the commander of St. Lawrence River area, which suited me very well. I originally was born in Montreal, and because I had a French mother, I spoke French from birth. So that was a help. We left, I think it was New Year's Eve from England.
And that would have been 1961.
And we sailed from Liverpool on the Empress of England, for Sir John New Brunswick. Now, this again meant taking the youngsters out of school in the middle of the school year. They'd gone in the middle of the school year, and they came out in the middle of another school year.
Right.
And we went to Sir John, and we went to train up to Montreal. And, you know, there was no time break in this. I was to go right to the new job. And an interesting difference here with other countries, we had a number of friends in the Royal Navy, and I remember one chap, captain, he was going to take command of a brand new ship, one of these missile destroyers, or really they're cruisers,
mm-hmm.
they're big ship businesses. The Hampshire, I think. And I said, when are you joining? Oh, he said, I don't have to join till the 1st of September. So I
really?
Said, what in the world do you do between January and September? Oh, he said, I'm going on leave, but then I'll take a lot of courses. He said, I have to learn some of the new weapon systems in my new ship. But he said, you know, there's lots of time. You're lucky. And this applied to the ones in the British Army and in the Air Force. They all seemed to have lots of time to go and get adjusted. Whereas, certainly, the trend and the form in the Canadian services, they told you and get on with it right away, and if you were very, very lucky, you would get some leave in between.
Right.
Because very often, when you were shifted, which was usually in the summer, you had an accumulation of your entire annual leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you were lucky, you could have 2 or 3 weeks leave during the time that you were. And that meant you had to pack up, and usually the moves were pretty substantial, you know. We moved from 1952 from Victoria to Halifax, and in 1954 we moved from Halifax to Ottawa. And this meant uprooting school plans and all the rest. And in most cases, the moves came sooner than expected.
Right.
Some character would say, oh, you're going to stay there for 3 years. And at the end of 2 years, bang, you move. So that, well, we arrived in Montreal, and I had to get somewhere to live. And Montreal at that time, in fact, the province of Quebec was a difficult place in the city to find accommodation. And they had very strict rental rules there. You could rent a place, but it was for a fixed term. And there were penalties if you tried to break the lease.
Right.
And substantial penalties.
And in your capacity and always being uprooted all the time, that could be somewhat costly.
And also there was the option of buying a house, but then housing was very expensive at that time, and I just couldn't compete with that. And anyway, I didn't know how long I was going to be in Montreal. Well, we drove up from, we were staying in a motel in Montreal, in the Sheen. Because my headquarters were in LaSalle, which was one of the which was a naval complex. There was a very large supply depot and the school, and then there were various other naval activities that were scattered around. There was an armament depot across the river in Long Gale, and there was the shipbuilding organization with the Vickers and, you know, that sort of thing. And I also had an office downtown in the Federal building. And we drove up to Ottawa because we were able to park our boys with some friends and our daughter with my mother and sister who lived there. And we were staying in a motel. And one morning at 8 o'clock, before that, I was just sitting on the side of my bed getting dressed when the phone rang. And it was the chief personnel, Admiral Budge, who's mm-hmm. a friend and a neighbor of mine up the street. And he said, "Charles," he said, "I can't tell you why, but," he said, you're not to buy a house." And he said, "You're to be very careful how long a lease you get involved in Montreal." And I said, "How in the world is one supposed to compete with this?"
Right, not knowing.
Exactly. I said, "This is you're putting me in a spot." He said, "That's all I can tell you. I can't even tell you why."
That didn't help out too much at all, I imagine.
So, I wasn't very happy about that. And my family were shaking their heads, too. Well, we went back to Montreal. We dads and hunt around. And we were very fortunate. We saw an ad for a sublet of a house in Beaconsfield, which is one of the suburbs of Montreal, just beyond Dorval. And because where we lived was very relative to where the schools we should have. And as a result of that, this was an American who was in some oil company or something, and he was being moved before his lease was up, and he was prepared to turn over the balance of his lease to us, and he was twisting our arm to do it because he wanted to get on his way. This was in the depths of January, and he wanted to get to Florida or Texas or something where the weather was better. So it was a very nice house, so we took it. And our furniture and whatnot had been in storage in Ottawa while we were overseas, so it wasn't too difficult. And I was able to get the boys into schools. The high school for the boys was quite handy, and the daughter went to the elementary school in Beaconsfield, which was within walking distance. So, and this was in an English-speaking region section.
Were the kids brought up at all speaking French?
Not
because
really,
you were
very successfully. They had acquired it since, but and daughter attended Ottawa University 4 years, where there were a lot of French kids. She'd taken French in school because they taught it very well in Ontario, but she learned it, became very fluent. Pat, who's in the Army, he took the Army immersion course, and he speaks French.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim was in the Federal Public Service, and he learned it the same way. So there, all through the only person ever speaks French is myself. Hope Bay isn't exactly the place where you use it every day. Well, we stayed in Montreal for a matter of, in my case anyway, 6 months. But it was not until April that I discovered what was cooking. But the happy thing was that this lease I had been able to get ran to the end of August. The owner of the house worked for CIL and was working then in Kingston, Ontario, the plant there. Well, my duties were mostly, you might say, representational. I was Mr. Navy in the
Montreal area.
Montreal area. And I didn't have any ships in my region, but they were promised to be visiting ships, etc., in the summertime. And there was a Naval Reserve Division there in Quebec City, and one of my tasks was to inspect the Sea Cadet Corps, and there were a lot of them right down the Gaspé Peninsula and all over Hell's Africa. And they were busy, and most of our activities were on weekends. But I was fortunate. I had a car and a driver, and it was a busy time. And as the winter petered out, things got a bit better as far as the weather went. And I knew the senior Air Force officer was the commander of Air Defense Command, and there was Hubert, he was an old friend of mine from Ottawa, Bill McBrien, and the general officer commanding the Army area was General Frank Bluey, who I knew. So, you know, we were amongst good friends. Well, in April, I got a letter from the Chief of Naval Staff, Admiral Rayner, saying that they had decided that I would have to be moved to Ottawa and be promoted to Rear Admiral to take over the job of Naval Comptroller. Now, looking back all these years, I didn't particularly want to be the Naval Comptroller. Finance was not... I'd been in logistics all my life.
But you had had some experience before with that side of it, a little bit?
Oh, yes. I had, right through my career, I had experience with pay and cash accounts and all that. But the controller, first of all, handled the naval budget and was responsible for, with everybody else, assembling the estimates to be, you know, submitted to the government and the Treasury Board and all the other things. And we also were responsible for organization, that is, the different activities, the people that would man them, establishing the complements or the numbers. We were responsible for developing systems and procedures, and there were a big staff in the controller's department, but it was all massaging paper of one kind or another.
Could you say that it was a somewhat of a frustrating experience because you, in that capacity, you saw the RCN shrinking, the force becoming smaller and smaller, their budget becoming smaller during this time?
Yes, it were very difficult times. I had to report to Ottawa on the 3rd of July, 1962. Now, the reason why it was delayed that long, because the appointment of controller was empty at that point. There was somebody doing it on an acting basis. And the reason for that was that amongst my sort of secondary duties, I was an honorary aide-de-camp of the Governor General for the Montreal area.
Mm-hmm.
And the Queen Mother was coming to Montreal in June of that year to present colors to the number of Highland regiments, the Black Watch and some others. And Black Watch was a Montreal militia unit of great, has been there for a long time and had a very distinguished record. So I was told by the CNS that I had to be there when this happened. And it also happened that I knew the Vanniers very well, because they had been friends of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to stay there long enough to do my thing with them. They came to Montreal at other times, and I appeared and did my stuff with them. But particularly for this occasion of the visit of the Queen Mother.